Penguin Random House Canada Audio presents Some of My Best Friends and Other White Lies I've Been Told by Tasia Eisen. Read for you by the author.
For my parents. Between me and the other world, there is ever an unasked question. Unasked by some through feelings of delicacy, by others through the difficulty of rightly framing it. All, nevertheless, flutter around it. They approach me in a half-hesitant sort of way, eye me curiously or compassionately, and then, instead of saying directly, "How does it feel to be a problem?" they say, "I know an excellent colored man in my town." W.E.B. Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folk, 1903. In 11 years working, I have always been extremely inclusive without even trying to. My best friends are rappers, my boyfriends have been rappers. Respect it. Lana Del Rey, Instagram, 2021. Introduction. Near the end of the first Toy Story film, an uprising takes place. The familiar conceit of the plot is that toys are conscious. They can think and talk, feel and plot revenge, but no one is supposed to know. Every time a person walks into the room, the playthings flop to the ground, still and glassy-eyed and all, "Who, me?" about having free will. Their oppressor is a kid named Sid, who likes to take apart his store-bought toys and remake them into new ones. Seems harmless, maybe even anti-capitalist. But because Sid's creations involve dismembered dolls, and also because he has bad teeth, a skull t-shirt, and the basement pallor of an incel, we're meant to recognize that he's a creep. This is not a bright and curious child trying to minimize his carbon footprint. This is a sadist getting off on torture. The circumstances the toys decide are grave enough to break the cardinal rule and reveal their sentience. Leading the revolt is our hero, Sheriff Woody. Sid has Buzz Lightyear, Woody's rival-turned-bro, strapped to a rocket. He's about to light the fuse when Woody stages a distraction, saying his action figure lines, though no one is pulling his string. Sid stops, frowns. The toy is all the way across the yard. The yard is empty. When he skulks over to Woody and picks him up, things turn personal. "That's right. I'm talking to you, Sid Phillips." Sid's face contorts in panic as the other shoe drops. He hasn't been making cool alternative toys. He's been butchering living creatures. Woody, not one for subtlety, really drives this point home. "We don't like being blown up, Sid. Or smashed. Or ripped apart." What happens next is straight out of a horror film. Enough to terrify the kid I was in 1995. The army of toys closes in like they're about to rip Sid apart. Mutilated dolls rising from muddy puddles in a sandbox, lurching with outstretched arms, crying, "Mama!" The most iconic of Sid's experiments, a one-eyed baby's head on a crab-like metal body, drops from the sky and caresses Sid's temples. This has already been pretty traumatic for the kid, but what truly breaks him is Woody's final demand. The sheriff rotates his head a cool 360 and says, in a voice that drips with threat, "So play nice." This scene is my favorite metaphor to describe what it's felt like over the past several years as corporations, public figures, and cultural industries became fluent in the language of social justice. A bunch of objects opening their mouths to declare a revolutionary consciousness. After this decade's uprisings against police violence, the wave of inclusion statements, high-profile hires, and higher-profile apologies meant that too many things were suddenly talking. Entities that should not, in any rational view of the world, have been able to speak at all, candy brands, emojis, style guides, road surfaces, the New York Times bestseller list, were suddenly animate. Alive. They stroked my temples and chucked me under the chin, vowing that a new order was on its way and, what's more, I was gonna like it. Sometimes the noisemaking led to changes in systems and policies that have made them more equitable. Mostly, the noise was an end in itself to prove its makers were in step with the times. Not long after watching Toy Story, I became a voice actor, a job I've held for more than 20 years. When white celebrities swore off playing cartoon roles of color, our field was hit with public scrutiny. Animation was suddenly in the news, and reporters were especially keen to learn from racialized actors and our supposed vindication. I also work as a magazine editor, another field not known for being colorful. There, too, a senior leadership professed their respect for Black lives. Despite all the counter-evidence in what they'd published, I sensed heads swiveling in my direction. All of this felt unsettling, but none of it was new. Certain establishments have always said what they think the public wants to hear, whether for profit or cachet. The more I thought about it, the more I realized this dynamic is predominantly how I, and I'd venture most people, have long interacted with the institutions that shape my life. They let us down and we adapt. Then they apologize for letting us down and promise to fix things. Then they break their promises shortly afterward or never act on them at all. This book is about how we live and what we demand amid such token apologies and promises. Some of these acts are easily knowable for what they are. Progressive language thinly pasted over capitalism and white supremacy. Take the flexible use of the word anti-racism, whose colloquial meaning has been diluted from actively opposing violence into a synonym for being nice and buying stuff. Or elevating art by Black creators solely for what it says about trauma, but not for what it says about beauty or what it means to be alive. Or buttoning a racist comment with, "Some of my best friends are." At other times, progressive language is closer to founding myth. The story a country tells itself about its moral superiority, or the law about its perfectibility, or white feminism about its vulnerability. Taken together, these acts coalesce into a distinctive force, the pull of our attention away from foundational cracks to point towards something prettier out the window. In these essays, I call that bait and switch lip service. We know this move so well by now, and have become grudging experts at spotting it. It's like the moment from 30 Rock when Steve Buscemi's private eye character tries to blend in with a group of students by wearing a backwards cap and band tee and asks, "How do you do, fellow kids?" Nobody was ever going to buy that. This book zeroes in on that type of moment, of slangy speech so clearly at odds with the speaker's underlying aims, to explore how this dynamic has become such a big part of contemporary life and how we might resist the world it tries to sell us. When I was younger, I often found myself mistaking lip service for the real thing. The journey of this book, out of complacency and into demand, is also often my journey of exploring the contexts that have shaped and implicated me. The first essay in this collection is about entering the colorblind utopia that I, and much of the public, once imagined cartoons to be, and why we won't reach a more equitable industry by simply tweaking the casting process. The next is about my teenaged affair with the literary canon, growing up in a white suburb, and my failure to turn both of those things into an artistic practice. To round out the book's first cluster, I explore how the word diversity was defanged by a U.S. Supreme Court justice who feared the political left, and how that paved the way for the trope of the diversity hire. By the next few essays, I'm less sanguine. I look at the personal essay economy and white feminism, respectively, as separate but related systems that reward certain kinds of vulnerability as politically good. Then, I explore the gap between word and action in the North American legal system and how that first attracted and then repelled me from the law. The book ends by exploring several forms of resistance, the protest genre of the demand letter, recent calls for accountability in the publishing industry, and finally, my own demands of Canada's national fictions, after those fictions have spent years demanding everything from me. Every field I explore relies on its own kind of lip service to tell a story about moral rightness. How it plays out depends on the context, but what all of them share is the gulf between the scope of the problem and the inadequacy of the proposed solution. I've chosen lip service
Sample complete. Ready to continue?